Good evening. At this time, we begin the SICNET. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And with K2KEY Mel, we try to answer people's questions about this somewhat complicated hobby called ham radio. Person signs into the SICNET by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, and the yes means that you do have a question or a comment for the net. So do we have any check-ins? Please give me your call letters and name at this time.
K2GGW, Les, and yes.
W2JTW, Lou, and yes.
K2YO, Bernie, no.
WS2N, Paul, no.
Good evening, Dick.
Good evening, this is K2KEY.
Okay, so far we've got Les and Lou with a yes. Okay, I just doubled with somebody. We'll get back to you in a second. We got Les and Lou with a yes, Bernie with a no, Mel and Paul checking in. Who is the other person?
K2KHR Mobile, good evening, Dick. Joel, no.
Okay, Joel with a no. Anyone else to check in?
N2GRT, no.
GRT with a no. Okay, let's start off with Les. Les, we haven't heard from you for some time. Welcome back, and what would you like to talk about? K2TGW, K2LIW.
Good evening, Dick. Oh, I've been around, just a silent partner listening in the background. I have a fairly simple question. Being someone who likes to build antennae, most of which have been mistakes, and become other antennae, or antennae. Anyway, I have some leftover ladder lines, and there was an interesting article in the doctor was in on the latest QST talking about hooking ladder lines from using a little piece of a coax into the jack and then putting a ballon on it. It talks about a 4-in-1. Now, I know there are also 6-to-1 ballons besides a 4-to-1 ballon. Is that a little bit of a sufficiency actually there, or is it not really? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, about the nicest way to bring coax cable from your rig through the wall into ladder line that's outside the house is the coax cable is very forgiving. It doesn't care if it goes through a pipe, doesn't go through any kind of a metallic object or whatever, whereas with twin lead or ladder line, any metallic object that goes near, any dielectric materials that goes near will disturb it to some degree. The degree might be minor, but still, if you're a purist, bringing ladder line straight into the house is kind of less than ideal. There are some guys who brought it in through a wooden window that can be closed on it. Metal windows wouldn't be so good. The easiest way to go from coax to ladder line, twin lead, open wire line, any of the balanced lines is a so-called half-wave coax balance. That's where you've got a U-shaped piece of coax of any impedance, believe it or not. A U-shaped piece that's a half-wave long with velocity factor. Could be 70-ohm, 50-ohm, 100-ohm coax. Wouldn't matter because half-wave length of line repeats the impedance, so that's why it doesn't matter. But the half-wave length of line means that at the instant you're putting positive voltage on the left-hand side of the U, a negative voltage, your half wavelength earlier, is coming out of the right-hand side, and you feed those two ends to your ladder line, all three shields get connected together. The center conductor from your main transmission line coax goes to one side of the U, and the other side has nothing but the ladder line going there. All right, that is a 2-to-1 voltage step-up device, assuming the line is lossless. And whenever you step up the voltage 2-to-1, since impedance is a function of voltage squared, 3 squared is 4, it's a 4-to-1 impedance step-up. Very handy device. Works like a charm. I've used it often on VHF as well as HF frequencies. I've even used it on UHF frequencies. UHF frequencies, that's the method by which I feed the folded dipole or the T-match of the driven element of some of my 432 Yagis is fed with that exact device. So it works very well, has a lot of history, low and loss, and with a little bit of weatherproofing, no problem at all. And if the antenna you happen to be using also is designed for a coax feed, there's nothing stopping you from building another one of those and using it backwards at the top of the ladder line, at the antenna itself. Bring the ladder line back down to coax with a 4-to-1 balance into your antenna, which is made for, we'll say, 50 ohm coax. And now you get the best of all worlds. You're matching the coax input to the antenna. You're matching the coax output from the rig. You're going through the wall with no real grief. And you have the lowest possible feed line, the ladder line. So that's a very, very convenient way to go. Lots of guys have done it. And except for methods by which you mechanically suspend the ladder line to make sure it doesn't fatigue away on the end, make sure it's properly supported with those standoff insulators, that's a very desirable characteristic. Now, somebody may make an LC equivalent or a toroidal coil or whatever that has a 6-to-1 step up. Yeah, the ladder line, in theory, for that thing to really work well, because it's giving you a 4-to-1 impedance step up, it really is looking for 200 ohm line, and your ladder line is probably something considerably higher than that. Most ladder line is either 300, 400, or 600 ohm. You could ignore that. In other words, a little bit of standing wave ratio you're going to get at one end. An antenna tuner would easily take that back out because the whole system is so low in loss, it really wouldn't matter. If you did step up the impedance by 6-to-1, by some means, then yes, the 50 ohm line would become 300, and maybe it's a little bit closer to matching the ladder line. I wouldn't worry about those details. This technique is so easy to homebrew that any other technique of buying something specifically designed for the impedance step up would cost you some bucks, and I don't know if it would work as well. Now, let me pass it over to Mel. I bet you his guys have used ladder line. I bet you they've worked out some nice details on how they do it. So, Mel, how do the guys from the from your particular club, of which you're the president, the Kings County Radio Club, how do they usually feed their ladder line from the shack? K2KEY, K2RIW in the group.
Oh, well, there's been many ways, you know, outlined. Just mentioned a good way of doing it, Dick, very straightforward. The way I am doing it, of course, you know, I use the ladder line, 600 ohm open wire ladder line, the homebrew ladder line, which comes down for my full wave loop. And what I do with that, of course, is I bring it right through the wall. I think I've mentioned this a number of times. What I use is the feed through the wall is the spark units that they use in oil burners. So I guess they can call them, I guess they're porcelain type of units that they sell for the ignition system in oil burner system. They have a central rod that goes right through the porcelain. It gives you a very good insulator. You can easily drill the holes. You only have to drill a hole about 5/16, I think diameter was, through the wall. You can put them in and pack it, you know, outside so water will not get in. You're soldering your wires right through the metal pin outside. And in the shack, I continue with the open wire feed right into the down tuner that is the Johnson Kilowatt matchbox that has link coupling. Actually, it doesn't use a balance type like many of the tuners that are now produced. It uses link coupling for a balanced antenna wire, such as we're just talking about, whether it be 300 or the 450 ladder line or the 600 line. Another unique way, of course, is that way that a lot of guys have been using it, is using two pieces of a coaxial cable. Using just the center of the two pieces of coaxial cable, joining the shields outside and using the two centers of the coaxial cable, soldering it to that point, and then bringing it into the shack that way, Dick, as now you have two pieces of coax coming in, and basically that's another way of doing it. I mean, there's so many ways you can stick. You can stick the balun outside. A lot of people stick the balun right outside, as you say, in a waterproof box, and convert it right there from the lateral line right into a coax system. Then bring that into the shack. There's no, you know, reason to not to do it that way. So there's 100 ways that it seems to be to do it. Everybody comes up with another idea how to bring it in. But I'll say one thing. The lateral line, no doubt, still an excellent way. After all the years, goes way back, so an excellent way to bring a such as from a dipole or whatever, you know, if you want to use that type of configuration down into the shack. I think it still makes an excellent antenna system, especially if you're going to feed things like loop antennas. Works extremely well with a loop antenna. This is KTKQY, back to them.
Here we go. Okay, I've got some words to add to what Mel just said, but let's see what Rich has got to say. N2EO, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, I hope you understand the point. MFJ makes something called the INN ballot box to convert some coax to lateralite. DX Engineering also has what they call the low power, good up to 10 kilowatts. Yeah, Dick.
Okay, so both MFJ and DX Engineering have a device that does it. Those porcelain feed through devices that Mel was mentioning are called igniters. You walk into a oil burner aftermarket component selling place. My favorite one is Sid Harvey, S-I-D space Harvey, H-A-R-V-E-Y. You look them up in the phone book, and they've got the stores scattered around Long Island. And I do my own oil burner maintenance, repair, upkeep, and whatever, have for 38 years. And so I go to Sid Harvey, I buy the parts, and those things are called igniters. They're on a shelf in the store. You'll find five different styles of them, some of them big, small, whatever. They're rated for the 10,000 volts that comes out of the transformer that does the ignition process of your oil burner. And so they certainly have the standoff voltage. And a crafty guy can put those through a panel of his construction or modify the walls that he go through. So, as you can see, Sid, lots of ways to do it. A pair of coaxes is not a bad way either. You would worry about what impedance of coax a pair to feed through the wall. And it really wouldn't matter because you're probably only going to use to go through the wall something like 6 inches or a foot of coax, the pair, that matches the twin lead on the inside versus the outside. This is on the assumption you've got some kind of an antenna tuner which is made to feed twin lead or lateral line directly. And MFJ, among other companies, make such a device. And the impedance of the coax wouldn't matter because a foot of it at, say, for instance, 80 meters is 1/300th of a wavelength. And you study that on a Smith chart, so to speak. It's an extremely minor perturbation. When it comes to transmission lines, you can step up or down in impedance and make great big jumps. Even with waveguide, you can make jumps in the size of the waveguide. If you only do it for a short number of wavelengths, the wave never knows anything happens. You can get away with murder. So you've got more choices than you know about there, Les. Your biggest problem, Les, is you've got so many solutions to the problem, it's going to be a little bit hard for you to choose the one that's your favorite for your particular QTH. K2TGW, K2LIW in the TechNet.
What do they always say? Sometimes too much information. Well, I'll have to pick one. Next time it warms up on the weekend, we're going to try one of these. Today I did have to put a feed line into my rotating dipole. That went kaplooey, but put a new feed line, it worked perfectly. All right. I will pick one, and I will let you guys know once I get it through it and done again. Take a couple of weeks or one more warm weekend. Thanks for the help again, Dick. You're, as usual, always Johnny on the spot. K2 teaches us.
Check in. We'll pick you up in a second. And Lou, Glad to hear that you're going to come back and tell us how it works, success or non-success. Check-in, go right ahead and give us your call letters and name.
Good evening, Dick and Annette. This is November 2, Kilo Delta November, Codge, Mobile right now. And if you have time, I do have a question. If you could put me at the end of the list, please, Dick.
Okay, you sound real good right now, Codge. Tell us how long you think you're going to be mobile. Should we grab you now before you get out of range, so to speak?
No, I'm going back home from Lynbrook, just going up to the North Shore and Locust Valley, so I'll be in range and then brief break while I get inside.
Okay, Kaj, we'll be right back to you. At the rate we're going, we should be there in 20 minutes or so. Lou, W2JPW, what would you like to discuss tonight? You got it, Lou.
Hey, good evening, Dick, K2RIW. TechNet, W2JPW. In good old Allendale, New Jersey. I've been reading in QST lately quite a bit about D-Star, and I looked it up on the internet and tried to find some information on local activity on this digital mode that ICOM is pushing so hard, and I find very little information. There's a couple of stations that are mentioned, but I don't hear anything on 2 meters or 440 except one station at 449.175, which is a digital station, but it seems like it's some sort of packet arrangement or the digital equivalent of packet just by the pattern of transmission, even though I can't copy any of them. Obviously, I don't have any digital equipment here. But I'm very interested in digital voice specifically, and I've also been trying to get information on that, you know, the technology of it, other than an article in QST a few years back. I don't have anything. I looked that up on Google, and there are a lot of very interesting articles on IEEE. The only trouble is I can't read them because I'm not a member. I don't know what it costs to be a member, but I'm seriously considering joining just for that reason. It doesn't cost too much. So if you know anything about the local D-Star activity, or if anybody on the frequency knows, I'd very much be interested, be very much interested in hearing about it. K2RIW and the group W2JPW.
Okay, there's a couple of guys on frequency. I think Rich N2EO has some knowledge on it. There's a chance that Mel has some knowledge. But before I pass it over to them, let me tell you about the IEEE, of which I'm a member for 35 or 38 years, some crazy number. If you're joining for the first time, I think membership is going to cost you like $150. It's kind of pricey. And to join the Explore program, which allows you to download articles, is another couple of $100. I think it's $360. So unless you're running a pretty big company and you think you're going to do a lot of exploring, I guarantee you're not going to use that service. I may be wrong on some of those numbers, but that's the last time I checked. If you go to a good technical library, at Brooklyn Poly Institute on Long Island, and I'm sure New Jersey has a number of colleges that have a good technical library, there you will find all of the back issues of IEEE proceedings, antennas and propagation, microwave theory and technique, all of these individual groups within IEEE. You'll find the hard copy sitting in that library. You open it up, you'll look at the article and say, yeah, that's the one I want to read, and you'll make a Xerox copy of it on their machine. And as long as you're just doing it for your own research and you're not publishing the article, there's no real problem. That's the easiest way to get a hold of some of these great articles that are in the IEEE. But to get them on the internet is a real pain, as you can tell. Now, for the people who are re-upping this year, when you re-establish your membership in a particular society, like MTT or AP, Microwave Theory and Technique, Antennas and Propagation, there's a hidden secret in when you re-up your membership online, there's some kind of a secret way in which you check off a particular box, and you do get access to the Explore type material that is published from that particular journal, not all of the IEEE articles. So as you can see, it's troublesome. So when it comes to D-Star, which I think is an ICOM creation, I have the impression it has never gained very much popularity in the United States. Possibly it has gained more popularity in Australia or Japan. And I wonder if either Mel or Rich have more direct knowledge about it. Each one, if you've got something, tell me right now and then we'll turn it over to you. K2LIW.
This is K2KEY.
Okay, Mel, if you know something about it, tell us what you know.
It's a reliable service. This is the future possibility, I'm sure, of a lot of emergency services. The problem is it's a hard sell for amateur radio because it needs changing over the repeaters, putting in new repeaters. And, of course, purchasing handy talkies or whatever. So at this point, that's basically what it comes down to as far as the situation is going to be. You know, before amateur radio operators are going to start to junk all the stuff that we have right now and buy all new, it's going to take a lot of input by ICOM and incentive before I think you're going to see it, you know, come into regular use. Maybe in the next couple of years we make separate repeaters that will, you know, be D-Star repeaters. But I think that's the way, the only way to increase it very slow, Dick, because it's a hard sell for them. For what you have to lay out, what a club would have to lay out, is between, as I say, convincing all the members to buy some handy talkies or whatever, and changing the repeater over. Go ahead.
WD2HWW, what's your comment?
Okay. Mel, I think I see where you're coming from, and boy, it doesn't sound easy. Let's see now. Bernie said no, Joel said no, and Taj said yes. Taj, N2 Kilo Delta November, I think it is, if you're still available. Go right ahead with your question, Taj.
Hi, Dick. Yes, I'm here. Thanks. With regard to power supplies, I have an older Calrad, I believe it is, if I remember right, at home. 35 amp power supply, linear type device. And I guess what I'm looking for is more opinion, but as a power supply gets older, I'm sure it could be subject to different problems. Could it be one possibility of creating a lot of noise on the HF radio? Could that be one source? I know the way to do it is get another power supply, plug that in, and see if the noise goes away. But if I was to get new power supplies, and I guess it's really a matter of what I think I would like to do, but is there any advantage to using one larger, say, 50-amp power supply that's supplying the HF rig and one or two mobile rigs, as long as it's capable of supplying the proper current? Or am I better off using smaller supplies, but multiple ones of them, to supply the couple different radios I have around the house?
Yeah, I see where you're going with that one, Kaj. And that's I think there's no hard answer for that. Each guy you talk to has his own solution. If a guy's at a flea market and somebody is selling at a real good price a 75-ampere power supply, and he buys it, and if he's happy with the way it performs, he hooks up everything to it. A heck of a lot of other guys start off with a 15-amp supply, and they want to power a couple of other things, and they buy some other supplies, and they feed them into separate rigs. Now, when it comes to a power supply making noise, with rare exception, power supplies really don't wear out. Yes, in the old days, when you had 5U4GY and vacuum tubes doing the rectifying, you could get some peculiar characteristics as the power supply ages. Modern-day power supply, with rare exceptions, doesn't suddenly start misbehaving, doesn't start suddenly becoming noisy. If it was a switching-type power supply, there are examples of switching power supplies which will make a fair amount of noise into a really sensitive HF rig, in which case there's a couple of possible solutions. Guys have put some very good bypass disceramic capacitors on the output leads, and also the output leads to ground, the case of the power supply. And in some cases, they've managed to do a pretty good job of quieting down a switching power supply. Another thing that happens, particularly if you're feeding a brick-type amplifier, a 6-meter, 2-meter, or 450 brick-type amplifier, one of the well-kept secrets is that the plus 12-volt input lead on a brick amplifier, when, say, for instance, you're using a Mirage Baker 1016, which is capable of taking 10 watts in and producing 180 watts of output, it probably produces 5 watts on its 12-volt lead comes flying out of there. And from the 5-volt, when the 5 volts of 150 megacycles comes flying out of there and goes into your power supply, there are some cases where the rectified RF energy getting into the power supply shifts its reference voltage, and funny things start happening. And again, putting good bypass capacitors on the power supply can cure it. So I personally like the idea of buying one very good power supply and feeding everything with it. If you want to be on the super safe side, you put individual fusing to the individual rigs, because let's face it, if you've got a 75 ampere power supply feeding a rig that only draws 25 amps, and if your 25 amp goes into a rig, goes into a failure mode, and it's drawing 45 amps and it's burning itself up, but the power supply doesn't protect itself until it sees 75, you can see what would happen. So to be on the super safe side, lots of bypassing, checking with some of the techniques you've already described, borrow a power supply from somebody or feed it from an automobile, and make sure the noise is not just something local on your antenna that you think is coming from a power supply, by way of a substitution test, you can find that out real fast. And then individual fusing from that power supply into the individual rigs would be a very conservative way to go. N2, KDN, I think it is, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, great, thanks. That answered a lot of questions, and you do have my call sign correct, November 2, Kilo, Delta, November. And I think you also answered a second part of the question I forgot to ask, was with regard to switching power supplies, if they are good on HF rigs. I kind of have an inkling that they're a little better for, say, a VHF FM rig that's sitting around, but as far as protecting your HF rig from noise, probably better off with a straight-up linear.
Well, switching power supplies in the past have had a mixed bag of success and failures. Some switching power supplies designed by the manufacturer to be plugged into a rig itself. In other words, it's an option you buy, and it's an empty space in there, and you put in the switching power supply. There have been a couple of cases of people who are not happy with the results. And when it comes to a well-designed switching power supply that sits on the outside, most people are happy. However, are there bad designs of switching power supplies out there that make a lot of noise across the whole HF band? Yes, there are a few. And if you want a really, really good switching power supply, the top of the line, the Cadillac of homebrew switching power supplies, is the one that was done by XQ2FOD, X-Ray Quebec number 2, Foxtrot Oboe Delta. Manfred Mortenwig, who is one of the chief electronic engineers for the European Southern Observatory in Chile, he had a pivotal article in the December issue 1999 QST, and the continuation of the article in the January issue 2000. It was the lead article in 1999 QST, December issue. The first thing you look at when you look at that switching power supply is you're going to say, gee, it's got a lot of parts. The second thing you're going to discover is that even the switching transformer, he home-brewed, because in Chile, you can't just walk into Radio Shack in Santiago, Chile, and buy the parts you want. I mean, he's in the outback of the world by your and my standards, and he had to home-brew everything. But he had an extremely well-designed, extremely efficient power supply, switching type. I think it runs at 90% efficiency. It self-protects. It adjusts its drive power to the transistors that are doing the switching as a function of what current output. That power supply is the second or third generation. He's the guy who supplies the power supplies that are used on the mountaintops for the repeaters that are in Chile. He's one of these real persnickety engineering types where whenever the power supply on top of a mountaintop fails, these guys got to go climb the mountain and fix it, so he wants it to be reliable. He keeps records as to what was the failure, and he beefs up everything that ever failed. And what you're looking at when you look at that design is, man alive, is that a switching power supply? And so that's the Cadillac of switching power supplies. If you want to see a really good design, and you go to his website, and it turns out the two articles in the December issue and the January issue of 2000 on that particular article only is one-third or one-half the information he published on the subject. And even though each one of the articles goes on for three or four pages of explanations, diagrams, methods of construction, whatever, you go to his website and you establish communication with him, as I have, and he'll dump out to you a compact file that gives you all the other information that didn't make it into the article. So if you want to be an expert in that subject, that's the place to go. Back to you, Kaj. N2, Quebec, Delta November, K2LIW.
Check in.
Check in. We'll pick you up in a second.
Okay, Dick, great. Thank you very much. As usual, I always get a tremendous amount of information. Very beneficial. I did come up with another question that I had lingering in the back of my head. If you have time for me, eventually, I'd appreciate it. Just having to do with toroid coils and RFI. N2KDN, back to you, Dick.
And by the way, one further piece of information on Manfred Mortenweg, that's the man's name, on that switching power supply. His method of testing the switching power supply was to put it under full load, which I think is 40 amperes, and he connected a antenna directly from the output of the power supply with a coupling capacitor directly into an HF receiver, and he scanned the receiver from 3 to 30 megacycles to see if the receiver could pick up any noise from the switching power supply, and he found none. That's a test. Okay, I'll fire your second question, Kaj. But before you do, let's just find out who the caller is on for the check-in, because he's going to be next. Check-in, give us your caller and name, sir.
Good evening, everyone. This is Fred, KC2OES, and I have some comment on the subject matter that you're currently discussing.
CB2HWW with the D-Star info, Dick.
Okay. How he recognized, and Fred, since we haven't left that particular subject yet, go right ahead, Fred, with your information.
I've had the same kind of struggle with trying to figure out how to do the same type of situation, but I think I came up with my solution. Some food for thought. It's not for everybody. It depends on what your shack is like and your pocketbook, so on and so on. What I did was install banks of gel cells, solar. I wired my shack up a 12-volt, which entails light, cigarette lighter, and so on, and a trickle charger and a generator. So no matter what, I'm running on the gel cells all the time. They're being charged by the solar or from 110-volt when I need to. And basically, that's it.
That's an extremely good solution when it comes to being green, having an alternate source of power. I can't think of that now. Alternate energy? You know what I mean? The only place where that would give me a little bit of trouble in my particular case is that my favorite mobile-type 2-meter all-mode rig is a Kenwood 751 Alpha. 2-meter all-mode, I think it's got 30 watts of output. That's the good news. And when it's running from an automobile where the alternator is running and the car is putting out 13.5 volts, the rig is happy. Come down to 12.01 volts or less into that rig, and the phase lock loop goes crazy. I think the regulators all inside are all built for exactly 12 volts of output, so to speak, and you give it less than 12 volts, and in the sideband mode it goes crazy, and the FM mode it goes crazy. But that's a pretty good rig. So if you happen to be not charging your gel cells, and they through the voltage drop in your wiring, and the gel cells put out 12 volts, and you get 11.95 volts into that particular rig, that would give you some grief. Now, I think that's a rare situation. I believe most of the well-designed rigs that are popular will run at 11 volts, 11.5 volts. But that particular one, by way of we, the 10X group on Long Island, the 10 gig group using X-band frequencies, we
decided that that was a very desirable rig for tunable IF for our 10 gig operations, and we bought six of those particular kit transmitters, Kenwood 751A, 2 meter almost. Either six or seven of them we bought. Every single one of them does that. Below 12.01 volts, the rig goes crazy. So, I've got one in my automobile right now. I have to make sure that the automobile is running and the battery is being charged, and it has been charged for about 30 seconds before I turn on that rig. Otherwise, people will complain to me that I don't sound good. But except for that very minor problem that I had, Fred, you've got a darn good solution there. As long as we're on Cash and he's about to come into his house, let's finish off with him. You had a second question, Cash, go right ahead. N2 Kilo Delta November, K2LIW in the deck net.
Thank you, Dick, and thanks to Fred for that additional info. That's a good idea. I would have something like that when I eventually put my rigs into my boat, basically run off the battery. But my second question is, I've got some RFI. I play around a little bit with the digital modes on HF, and I have some RFI coming into and out of the computer, which seems to be a chronic problem for most of the guys. And the simplest solution that everybody seems to, on the forums that I've been reading, there's a lot of chatter about that. Basically, toroid coils and wrap your cables around those, and basically gets rid of the problem simply and easily and fairly cheaply, too. Just by way of experimentation, I don't know, I've seen their square-shaped ones from, like, Radio Shack that you can clip off and on, that I can try playing with that. With the toroid material being separated like that, is there an advantage, or for what I'm doing, playing around with RFI, would that be satisfactory, at least for a temporary basis, until I solve the RFI problem?
It seems to me, Cash, that most of the people who buy these ferrite devices and run their wiring through them, most of the time they're fairly happy with the results. I don't think it's not going to take your RFI from the computer down by 60 decibels, but it is going to remove quite a few decibels of it. And there's a whole art and science to how you put the wiring through one of those toroid transformer things. There are various versions where you can wrap the wiring multiple turns through there, and you get a little bit more action. In my opinion, one of the best ways of doing it, if you've got a plus and a minus lead, or the whole 110-volt plug, so to speak, if that's where the RFI is coming from, and it takes a bunch of tests to find out where it's coming from, it'd be nice if both of the hot and return of your system both are wound through the toroid device together as opposed to separately. If you wind them separately, in some cases you run into a saturation problem of the ferrite, whereas together, most of the time it works better. That combined with filter networks you can buy and bypass capacitors you can add, almost every radio frequency interference problem is solvable if you use a divide and conquer type of philosophy. In other words, with the right kind of testing with sniffing devices, like you take, for instance, your HF receiver, you put a small piece of coax cable coming out of the back of the HF receiver, and you take the center conductor of the coax cable, extend it about an inch, fold it back, and solder it to the shield. This is the center conductor and the dielectric material left on it. But you solder it back to the shield, so you end up with a half-inch diameter loop antenna, so to speak, on the end of a piece of coax cable. You tune to the frequency where you're getting interference. You then use that sniffing device, which is a very small sensing device, and you put it near whatever you think is the cause. And you'll watch the S-meter go up and down, or you'll hear the sound coming out of your loudspeaker going up and down, and you'll soon find out what is the real source. Is it on the hot lead? Is it on the ground return? Is it on the keyboard wiring, and so on. So with that kind of sniffing technique, it's a beautiful way of taking an extremely small antenna that ordinarily has low sensitivity, but that's exactly what you want in this case. And if the source of your noise happens to be super strong, maybe you first put it through a step attenuator. Most of the time, that's not required. So with those kind of techniques, you can find out exactly which device inside of your computer is the noisy one. And therefore, you can go right to the source on the motherboard itself and say, hey, that's the guy that's doing it, and if I build a little metal cage around that guy or put bypass capacitors on his VCC leads and so on, I can stop it right at the source. So with techniques like that, if you're crafty enough, Akash, as I say, you talk to the experts on electromagnetic interference, this is what they do as an occupation. And with a little bit of a learning curve, and I wish somebody would write an article about doing this and putting it in the technical topics of QSC, I know we amateurs can do it, and therefore you don't have to stop using your favorite computer. You can make it compatible with your system. M2KDN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Great, thank you very much. That little zipper antenna you're talking about, I can put that on pretty much any length of coax so I can drag it around, or is it drag the rig around to the computer? And I got to keep the coax very short in of itself, or is it just that the center conductor has to be short when it's soldered back on itself?
Only the center conductor is short. And by the way, if you make that loop at the end where the center conductor goes back to the shield and it's soldered, and you make it half inch diameter, and if it happens to be not sensitive enough and you want more sensitivity, you can make it an inch or an inch and a half in diameter, so to speak. Now, that is picking up a small amount of the signal, and when you're on 3 to 30 megacycles, unless you're using the world's worst coax, the length of the lead from there into the rig doesn't matter. I mean, if you use 10 feet of RG58, and about 30 megacycles, that's got 1 dB of loss, which is probably close to the right number, that means your S-meter will read 1/6 of an S-unit lower through that length of cable. You don't have to drag the rig around. You can make that coax cable as long as you like. I strongly recommend you make sure, though, that the way you interconnect that sniffer to the rig, make it well shielded. In other words, good coaxial connectors with or without adapters. Make sure that none of your wiring to your sniffer antenna is leaky on its shield. Otherwise, you'll get some very confusing results. If, for instance, the shield going back to the rig, the PL-259, if that's what it was, isn't making good contact at the rig, where now your whole piece of outer conductor of your coax cable going to your sniffer antenna, if all of that becomes hot, well then moving it around to try and find out the source of the interference is going to be a lot more complicated. So other than shielding it, make that lead as long as you like. And when you do that, and when you start digging into your favorite computer and find out exactly where the noise is coming from, I wish you'd come back and tell us what worked, what didn't work, and how you went about it, Cash. Because I guarantee the problem you're attacking right now, I bet you there's a lot of people within the sound of you and my voice who are having a similar problem. N2KDN, KQLIW in the TechNet.
You know, I will do that. I have a feeling, though, it's really the HF rig getting into the computer that's causing the problem. Because it only really happens when I transmit, although there are some, as I've talked about before, with some of my RFI problems, there could be some things in my computer that are creating the problem. I think I also possibly blew out the sound card, because all I get is I get sound out of my speakers, but there's always a crackling going on, whether there's sound coming through it or not. And the only thing that fixes it is if I mute the speaker. So I have a feeling I kind of fried my sound card a little bit with my HF rig. But that's a fairly easy fix. And thank you very much for the help. I appreciate it. This is N2KDN.
Yeah, very fine, Kaj. I may have misunderstood you. When people report radio frequency interference, usually it's in the HF rig reception mode with a computer nearby making the noise. Now, if when you transmit your computer behaves or misbehaves, or your automobile misbehaves, that's a somewhat different problem. If your antenna is reasonably well shielded on its transmission line, if the antenna is not in the shack with you, but it's a reasonable distance away, and if you're using the right kind of a bowering device. Now, there are some people, for instance, that'll take a piece of RG8 coax cable, 100 feet long or 50 feet long, put the shield to one half of the dipole and the semiconductor to the other half, and when you do that, a fair amount of RF energy starts crawling down the outside of the coax cable. It'll come into the shack and it could give your computer grief. Whereas if you put the right kind of a balancing device, even a poor man's balance, of five turns of coax taped together up at the dipole, which acts as an RF choke to stop that from happening. By means like that, you can stop the RF from getting into the shack, and maybe your computer will be a whole lot happier. So these are some of my suggestions along those lines. Okay, Howie, you were about to give us more information about D-Star, and go right ahead and do it. WB2HWW, KQRW in the TechNet.
WB2HWW, I hope you can hear me better now, Dick.
Oh, yeah. Dead full quieting on the input. You're putting out some steam. Have some fun.
All right, Dick, first thing is this. D-Star is not popular in the New York area. There's one D-Star repeater in the New York City area that is on the Empire State Building. That's on 449175. It is not connected to the gateway. The problem, but let me just make this clear. D-Star is being used in a lot of other states like Alabama and California and some other places. The problem that I see in the New York area is this. If you want to put up a D-Star repeater, you have two choices. One, go to MetroCar, ask for a frequency. Or if you're a club or an individual, you decide you take one of your analog systems off the air and use that particular frequency for your D-Star repeater. Second, ICOM is the only company making D-Star equipment. So you're really limited to the manufacturer. D-Star is that the ICOM repeaters are not as well built as, let's say, a Motorola or a TE. A lot of repeaters here that are either used on VH9, you know, out of Mets or Micor, so you can't just take a commercial radio. Power chipsets that you might be able to get, then you got to build all the supporting stuff. So that's basically the situation. Will it take off? I think it will. I looked into putting up a D-Star repeater, but it's not user-friendly if you have a disability. If you can't see or you have it's all menu-driven. You have to tell it where you want to talk to. You actually have to program in your radio when you're calling. You just don't pick up the mic. It is a little not as easy to use as an analog system. Will it take off? I think it's going to be popular for emergency communications where they need text and GPS, where you want to have connectability to the internet. But as far as just, you know, chit-chatting, I think there are nice several years. And the problem is, who's going to go out and buy all those equipment? Who's going to finance it? That's where they have to, you know, buy to get the money for the repeater and for the infrastructure, and you have to have either a DSL or a cable or some type of high-speed system up to the site. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, WD2HWW.
I thank you, Howie. Lots of good information. It was Lou who asked that question about D-Star. So, Lou, if you've got any further questions for Howie, he seems to be a person reasonably well-informed. Now's the time to ask him. N2JPW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Howie. That's interesting. Yeah, that's the one I've been hearing. Apparently, they're transmitting some sort of data or other types. It's not voice transmission because it just doesn't have the pattern of voice transmissions. I've been listening every once in a while here on 449175, and it's on day and night. Every little while, you hear it come on a little. But, yeah, there do seem to be a lot of problems with it. It is popular down south. After Katrina, they seem to have gotten involved with it. But digital communication interests me. I don't know why, but it just does. And so I thank you for the information, and we'll turn it back to Nat, W2JPW.
Couple more comments on D-Star.
Okay, before I pass it back to you, Howie, when it comes to digital, Lou, definitely you want to look at the Joe Taylor techniques. Kilowatt 1, Kilowatt 2, Julia Tango, Joe Taylor's techniques for sending very, very weak Morse code-like signals, but still you read them off the computer screen, and boy, that message can get through even though it's 28 decibels below the noise. Wow. as he has some really fancy techniques there that use, I can't even think of the name of the Don protocol that he's using. Go ahead with some further information there, Howie.
The other thing is this, just recently the FCC...
If you're hearing me, Howie, your carrier dropped out.
Battery.
Okay, battery, understand. We'll wait till you replace the battery.
About that, the battery died on the radio. I'm coming in on a remote base. Sick. Do you think that this definitely happened? Just recently said that D-Star was not a repeater, it was a store and forward system. So there are guys who are going around and not getting these repeaters coordinated. The big problem is getting frequencies to use. So you basically have to either decide to use an existing pair or apply to, you know, your local coordinating groups. And that's the big issue. Go ahead.
Yeah, I can see how that would be an issue in the New York City metropolitan area, because I'm going to guess that there are very, very few frequency pairs that are available for either the 2-meter band or the 450 band. I'll bet you almost everything is booked solid with a waiting list. There probably are available frequencies, though, for 902 to 928. And there might be some frequencies available for the so-called 1296 band. I guess we call it 13 centimeter band, the L band band. So is that approximately what's going on here from your point of view, Howie? Go ahead.
There are frequencies available. It's all politics. I don't think I want to get into politics. I think there are frequencies available on 2 meters. And there are frequencies available on 440, but they are making equipment for 1.2. Well, 1.2 is wide open. There are no repeaters, really. There are no active repeaters in the New York area on 1.2. Actually, 900 is a lot more crowded than its 1.2 band. And I'll tell you, I don't know why people are not using 1.2, Dick. I've been experimenting with 1.2 for the last 17 years, 20 years, and I get, about 60% of the coverage they do on UHF. I mean, and the funny thing about 1.2 is if you run 1 watt, if you can make it with 1 watt, you'll make it with 10, and if you can't make it with 10, you're not going to, if you can't make it with 1 watt, you're not going to make it with 10 watts. 1 watt is about all you need into a decent antenna, and it has very good characteristics in the city.
Yeah, particularly if you've got a nice high location. If you've got a friend that can get you onto the, I don't care if it's the 40th floor, but if you get onto the Empire State Building, you're going to do very well on the 1.2 gig and the 900 meg band. And the 900 meg band, although it has a lot of activity as far as license-free equipment is concerned, almost everything there is by FCC command doing frequency hopping. So it doesn't dwell on any one frequency more than a few milliseconds, and therefore lots of individual services can coexist on that band, and the total amount of ham radio activity on 902, I think, is very, very light so far. And there's some extremely nice equipment available, but I've been doing some experimenting with, and I'm talking about these eBay available amplifiers called ELPA, ELPA amplifiers, which are surplus equipment, 10 years ago manufacturer, Motorola, continuous commercial service. They come in 600 watt, 300 watt, and 150 watt versions. They require 28 volts, and they've got numbers like 40 dB of gain, and boy, lots and lots of hardware is in there. And it's $5,000 to $10,000 worth of hardware you can buy in nearly brand new condition, sometimes unused with the original wrapper, and you pay numbers like $150 and $180 for it on eBay. So from my point of view, it's a real bargain. And I've been doing some experimenting with some of those, and a pair of those amplifiers, properly converted at 902 megs, will give you 1,000 watts of output. And 1,000 watts on that frequency will essentially melt a piece of RGAU. Not quite, but it makes it so hot to the touch, you think it's going to melt. So it's got some steam, and that's what you wanted to do. Okay, I wonder if you have any further questions on the subject, Lou. WTJPW, the guy who brought us this exciting question, KQLAW in the TechNet.
No, Dick, I really don't. But I'm certainly interested in that last few comments you had. I'd like to know where you can, on eBay, huh? Very interesting. What would I look it up under eBay? Go ahead.
A comment on the 902 band.
Okay, we'll pick you up in a second, Howie. If you Google, and assuming they're still available, approximately a year ago there were hundreds of these things available, and lots of guys who think they want 902 meg high power and repeater operation have sucked them up. If you eBay, if you do a Google search on the word ELPA, Echo Lima Papa Alpha, ELPA, and ELPA plus 600 watts, or ELPA plus 300 watts, or ELPA plus 150 watts, I think they stand for Extreme Linear Power Amplifier. That's what I think ELPA stands for. So you Google those particular words, and if there are any amplifiers available, you will find them. The guy who's got the conversion article is a KE5 guy named Mott, M-O-T-T-S is his first name. I can't remember his last name, but in a few minutes I'll look him up on my little list here. And he has a beautiful conversion article that's on his website, which shows you beautiful color photographs of what the amplifier looks like before you modify it and after you modify it. You essentially remove all the linearizing circuitry. At first you would think that's the wrong thing to do. An amplifier is so well designed and the linearizing circuitry is so complicated, you're way ahead of the game to just remove it. And this amplifier has got a nice big heat sink, fans that go across the heat sink, miniature fans buried inside the amplifier. The amplifier is about 2.5 inches high, about 10 inches wide, and about 18 inches deep with a great big handle on one side. It's a plug-and-play type thing, if you know what I mean. A replaceable module, a 600-watt replaceable module is what this thing is, and beautiful design. Very, very nicely done. Motorola brand-new equipment. So a little bit of a delay. You can find somebody to do some talking while I go look up my list. I'll give you the call letters and the website that you can go to where you'll see the conversion article for these particular amplifiers. And so from my point of view, they're a real bargain, Lou. WQJPW for any other fills, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. Yeah, I'll listen to...